Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hi, everyone. Ben here. I'm recording a quick addendum here on Monday, February 28th, before you hear a great chess conversation with Grandmaster Joel Benjamin and Harold Scott. The conversation with Joel and Harold was recorded about 10 days prior, so well before the ongoing atrocities in Ukraine, the invasion by Vladimir Putin into the country. I've been devastated by the news, as I'm sure a lot of you have. I've also been inspired by the spirit of the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, by the Ukrainian people, and also by the Russians who bravely spoken out against Putin's war crimes. Being a chess player and especially the host of this podcast, it sort of frames my perspective about Ukraine. I've never been there, but of course I've read about like David Bronstein and Leonard Stein, and I've talked to modern champions like Vasily Ivanchuk, Anna Muzychuk, and Ruslan Ponomaryov, as well as emigres like Yuri Krykin, Eugene Perelstein, Yaroslav Zhirabuk, and the list goes on. And, you know, with all of these people, I've been impressed by their kindness and their worldliness. So it really, helps me see the humanity involved in these atrocities. Online, there have been statements from Ukraine top player Pavel Ilyanov, and Grandmaster Alexander Syopa even posted a photo online of him having taken up arms to defend his land. So the images are devastating, and this all feels so unnecessary. So I'm wishing for the safety of all Ukrainian people and for them to swiftly and successfully defend their homeland and to begin to rebuild their country. Here on Perpetual Chess, the primary goal is going to be to keep things business as usual. They're going to be organic conversations, so often we will be providing an escape from all of the news, talking primarily about chess-related topics, as in this and the future episodes, but did, again, want to acknowledge what's going on. And I'll put a few links of ways you can help support Ukraine. U.S. Chess and Kasparov Chess are doing a great initiative to support chess players in particular, but obviously all the people need support. So anyone who's able to help, I encourage you all to do so. So hang in there, everyone. And on that note, here is an enjoyable interview talking chess with Grandmaster Joel Benjamin and Harold Scott. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined by co-authors this week. We have the six-time World Open champion, the three-time U.S. champion, 2020 U.S. senior champion, author, trainer, and return guest, Grandmaster Joel Benjamin, joining us, and his co-author, FIDE certified trainer, tournament director, and author Harold Scott. They have just written the fantastic new book, Winning the World Open: Strategies for Success at America's Most Prestigious Chess Tournament. It's a very unique book in my mind. I read it and enjoyed it greatly. And of course, I grew up in Philadelphia where it's often staged, so I have a lot of my own memories of this tournament, but it's part historical retrospective, part biographies of a lot of the sort of most successful players there, and part chess instruction, because there's some great annotated games. So I can't think of a lot of other books like it, and I greatly enjoyed it, and I'm excited to welcome our guests to the show. So welcome, Joel and Harold.
Hey, Ben, good to be here.
Thank you for having us, Ben.
Yeah, my pleasure. Just an amazing job on this book. I'm so excited to dig in, but I guess one thing we should say right from the beginning, we're recording here on February 16th. This will come out on February 28th, is this week the news broke that Bill Goitsberg, who of course is the founder of the Continental Chess Association, the founder of the World Open, his wife and professional partner Brenda passed away. Harold, I know that you had a lot of interactions with her. What could you say about Brenda Goitsberg?
Yeah, you know, the thing that I remember most about Brenda is whenever I would work tournaments with her, she always asked about my mother. My mother was undergoing illnesses, an illness of multiple myeloma. And whenever I saw Brenda at a tournament, first thing she would ask is, how is your mother doing? Now, she didn't know my mom at all, but she was caring and kind enough to ask about how she was doing. So when I think of Brenda, I think of, you know, how considerate she was.
Yeah, I didn't know her that well personally, but as I said, I played a lot of World Opens, and Bill Goitsberg, of course, can be a bit gruff, and he's often stressed when he's running the tournaments, but I remember Brenda as always a welcoming presence. Bill himself wrote an email to the Continental Chess email list, so I thought I would just quickly read what he wrote, which is, he wrote, "My heart is heavy with grief. The light of my life is gone. My wonderful wife, Brenda, passed away yesterday after an illness that had mostly confined her to bed for the past year. She had appeared to be recovering lately, making her passing even more of a shock. For almost 40 years, Brenda worked the registration table at many Continental Chess events, receiving late entries, buys, and withdrawals. We traveled together to almost every part of the USA. While I was usually preoccupied with various tasks and issues that arise at a big tournament, she never failed to visit a nearby food outlet and appear with my lunch or dinner or remind me that I had to eat. She had a great sense of humor." So rest in peace to Brenda. Was sad to read that news. And I had noted in the book that you mentioned that Bill missed his first World Open because she was ill last year.
Yeah. And so. I also wrote the article for New in Chess magazine, and you know, we were hoping to see her again next year, but sadly that she won't be at the 50th.
Yeah, and this year will be the 50th anniversary of the World Open. For listeners outside the U.S., it's kind of the flagship Open tournament here in the United States, large prize fund, lots of top players such as Joel Benjamin himself, and it's also sort of a staging ground for up-and-coming players. You guys write about a young Hikaru playing, a young Gata Kamsky, and so many others that pass through. So it's a great tournament to do a retrospective on. Joel, maybe you could tell us, I believe this book was Harold's idea, but so how did you receive it when Harold approached you about working on this book?
Well, you know, I believe I said in the introduction that this was the book that I wanted to write, but didn't know I wanted to write. So and you know, it's, in the publishing business, you know, every book, what they're always pushing is things to be instructional. And this book is instructional, but mostly it's a slice of history. And so, you know, not authors don't always gravitate towards that kind of thing. But, you know, when Harold pitched it, well, first of all, I was going to do it anyway, just, you know, out of friendship. But, you know, if Harold had approached me with a different project, then maybe, you know, I would have, you know, slapped my name on it, maybe written a few chapters or edited a few things. But because it was this, you know, a tournament, this tournament, I'm probably, you know, mostly more connected to this tournament than any other event. So, you know, I felt it very personally. And, you know, I ended up taking on a lot of the work. And it was, you know, just because I wanted to do it. You know, I had so much that I wanted to talk about, you know, from so many experiences, that it was really an enjoyable process, doing this.
Yeah.
See how I roped you into the project?
Well, we're glad that you did. I mean, again, it's so much detail, and there is some instructional chess content, but I get what you're saying. I mean, for me, what differentiates it are the stories and the historical context. And before we do get into sort of the chess lessons we can learn, and Joel, have you reflect on a few of your victories and disappointments along the way, I did think maybe, Harold, you could take us through a bit of the early beginnings of the World Open. I mean, now it's like we kind of take it for granted as this large scale event. Again, one of the biggest open tournaments in the U.S., generally the biggest. But what could you tell listeners that they might not know about how Bill Goitschberg founded it in the early days when it wasn't even yet in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, originally on 4th of July weekend, the tournament that CCA in the early days was doing was the Atlantic Open. And then he wanted to do something a bit grander, even though that was a successful tournament for CCA. And so he chose July 4th weekend to start this tournament that we now know as the World Open in 1973. And back then, it was there was only a handful of you know, titled players, not too many grandmasters, not like it is nowadays. In its second year, he did something very smart. He brought in Bent Larsen, which really lended credibility to this tournament early on, and lended to the World Open as it is by bringing in a top 10 player in the world at that time.
And he lined up some simuls for Bent Larsen to make it worth his while to fly across the pond.
He did, although they weren't as successfully attended as he hoped. But Joel has a little bit of history himself. Yeah.
Oh wow!
I played him. Yeah, 10 years old. I played Bent Larsen, and I think I was the last game finished, but he got me. he got me as an adult too. He was a good player.
And Joel, so that being the second World Open, was that your first one, or were you at the first one as well?
I played in the second World Open, 1974, in the booster section. You know, players who are familiar with the World Open know that there are multiple sections according to your rating category. Back then, it was just two, the Open and the booster, which was under 1800. And I was, I guess, about 1600 then, so the booster section was perfect for me. I played in it for 2 years before I graduated into the Open. But it was pretty cool to be part of that tournament. Just as a comment about the World Open, in one of the early articles, I don't remember which year it was, early Chess Life article, I believe World Open is in quotes, you know, because at the beginning it was, you know, it sounded like a joke to call it the World Open, you know, kind of like the World Series, right? But, you know, as history went on, it seems more appropriate because it really does, it has drawn great players from all over.
Yeah, Joel, I know you have kids. It's like in the movie Elf, where the New York City coffee shop has the world's best coffee sign, which you can find at basically, you know, a thousand coffee shops across New York. Yeah,
that's best dad. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's me. I got the proof.
Right, exactly. But yeah, it's lived up to its title subsequently. And speaking of pop culture references, before I forget to tell you guys, I did enjoy the little Seinfeld reference you guys got in with the grandmasters of their domain. deep within the book.
I think that was Harold. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't even catch that.
Are you sure? I thought it was you.
Really?
You guys are only supposed to not take credit for the errors, not the not the jokes that land.
We're glad you liked it either way.
So Joel, and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but you, Ilya Nizhnik, is nipping at your heels, but you still have the record for the most World Open titles, correct?
Yes, and I learned about this before I knew I was going to be writing a book about the World Open, but I learned about it from a piece that Dylan McLean did in New in Chess. He has a little column where he just, you know, talks about chess oddities, and you know, he listed, you know, like the most frequent winner of various tournaments in the World Open, and there was my name. It's like, I had never thought about it before, but I had tied for it 6 times, and of course, I joked in the book that I should I missed my opportunity to demand that everyone referred to me as 6-time World Open champion Joel Benjamin.
Well, I did get it in the intro.
Yeah. Of course, and, homage to Walter Brown, 6-time U.S. champion.
Yes. And in reflecting on the World Open, so obviously you've had your share of successes, but, you know, you don't always win. You played, you know, basically every year in your competitive prime, Joel. Yeah. So what, when you think of your tensest moment in the World Open, the most, I mean, obviously, you know, first prize this year is $20,000. You've got to adjust for inflation as you move backward, but generally that's sort of around the price point. So obviously it can be a significant boost to one's income. What was your tensest moment of all the times you were playing near the top at the World Open?
Wow, that's a tough one. You know, I would say that only the last time, my last victory in 2006, was I really thinking about the money, because by that time I was married and I had, you know, bought a house in New Jersey, and I started to think about bills for the first time in my life. So I was very conscious of that. And in the last game against the Grandmaster Sandipand or Chandra, depending on, you know, what they consider his last name to be on any given day, I was going for the win in that game with the white pieces. And I did not want to play it safe. And I should have won that game, because I thought, like, you know, let me go for the big money, you know, and I almost got, I don't know, 20,000, almost had 20,000 all to myself. But as it was, I tied for first every time. But, you know, I guess the ones that really kind of stick are those last round losses. And I had two horrible ones in 1983 and 1986. You know, I could have won a couple of more titles very early, 83. I played really a fantastic tournament, and then I lost the last round to Leonid Bass. And in 86, I lost to Yasser Seirawan in the last round. But, you know, this I talk about openly in the book, that you have to have the right kind of mentality. And, you know, I wasn't really good. I didn't really have the best open tournament mentality, because those last rounds, if it was the last round I needed to win, I was good at that, and I won some of those. But, you know, if I felt like I was already on top and I had everything to lose, it's difficult psychologically to not think about that. And that's one thing that I learned from working on this book and all the great interviews that we did with the champions, is those guys were really mentally tough, you know, like, yeah. they never said, oh, I was really nervous in this game. You know, it's like when they were in the zone, as we called it, they said, like, oh yeah, I felt so good. I knew I was going to win.
And whose mentality impressed you guys the most?
I'm going to say Yermo. Yeah, because Yermo in the 90s was invincible.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, once the decade ended, you know, his life changed a little bit and he had a tougher time. But for those years, he was always there. You know, like he picked up all those titles in a short amount of time. Some of them were clear wins and big scores. And he was, you know, he just ironed the prize, and you could not knock him off it. So for consistency, he was most impressive for me.
Yeah. For me, Shaba, certainly because of his fearlessness. And Golden, when he had that enormous year, he said that, you know, he was just feeling it from the first round. He was feeling something special, like this was my tournament. He was in what we talk about, a perfect emotional state for himself at that time. So he was in rarefied air.
Yeah. Yermo, for newer listeners, of course, being legendary Grandmaster Alex Yermolinsky, who's best known these days. I mean, he's done some videos for ICC and, semi-retired, affectionately known as Uncle Yermo. But yeah, I remember as an up-and-coming, I guess you could say, player at those World Opens, he was just dominant, as you say, Joel.
I have to point out something else about Yermo that you probably don't know. For 40 years, he has been a big-time Cincinnati Bengals fan. So he's in a little bit of mourning over the Super Bowl.
Ah, so he adopted the NFL when he moved to Ohio?
He moved to Ohio, but I think the Browns were just a horror show. So he decided to root for the Bengals. So he's a Bengals fan.
Shout out to Yermo. And, of course, by Shaba, we mean another legendary Soviet-era emigre, Alexander Shabalov, who told some great stories and, of course, has, as Harold alluded to, has that style that's so fitting for when you're navigating this field of lower-rated players, just crushing attacking style, schooled under Mikhail Tal himself. So yeah. Excellent choices. Yeah, and I love the little nugget about, Alexander Golden, who you guys mentioned about his the fact that he was basically giving odds in a lot of those years because he was a smoker.
Yeah.
had to run out in order to smoke during the games.
Yeah, not only smoking, but if you've played in World Opens in the latter years, when Bill put a lot of thought into the staging of the room, he would like to, for the open section, for the top boards to be in a corner where they would be least disturbed, which meant farthest away from the entry. So imagine that you're running low on time and you have to go to the bathroom. It was like a marathon to get to the bathroom and back. So it's really something. It's like maybe they should have given us little bottles, for the game. Or adult diapers for time pressure.
and Joel, you mentioned this loss to Yaz, not to dredge up bad memories, but was the painful aspect just the result, or was there something that happened in the game that made it particularly painful?
Well, the result, yes. But when I look back on it, he did one of these Yasser things. He gave up his Fian Ketod bishop to saddle me with an isolated pawn, but he weakened the light squares around his king. And objectively, this was good for me. This is a good position. And it's not just that I lost it, but I never had the mentality to win the game, even though winning the game would have tied me with Nick Defermian and given me a boatload of cash. I was never optimistic about the game. I was giving my opponent too much credit, even though I beat Yasser a lot of times after that game, So, I mean, I could have done it there, but that's the worst part of it, is that I just felt that I was in the wrong frame of mind for the game.
Okay. And Harold, you're, of course, a USCF expert hoping to make master, you mentioned, and you've been involved both as a player and a tournament director at the World Open. So what is your tensest moment in either capacity playing?
I haven't had the trials and tribulations like Joel has had under fire for many years. The tensest moment I had back, it was in the 80s when I was playing in the World Open in like 1985. I was playing in the under 1800 section, and I was 4-0. And I think at the time it was an 8-round tournament, so I was sitting pretty good. And then I overslept and forfeited round 5. And that just knocked the wind out of my sails at that point. So everything else in my World Open history has been a piece of cake. But that was a moment that is kind of still raw a little bit, because it was a spoiled opportunity, and I had nobody to blame but myself.
Yeah, I mean, managing nerves, managing sleep, even for, you know, people like you and I, Harold, people not playing for the top prize in the whole tournament, you know, that stuff definitely comes into play. So totally understandable. Well, another thing that I love about the book is that, you know, there's misadventures, tales of misadventures, you know, drinking, cheating, and we'll save some of them for the book, but I also want to dig into a couple of them. But first, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Listeners, I've got good news. I know you're looking for an update on my AIM Chess analytics, and I'm happy to report that I'm now only behind on the clock in Blitz Chess 69% of the time. Huge progress. So if I can keep up that 2% improvement in no time, I'll always be ahead on the clock, and I'll probably win more games because of it. And of course, with aimchess.com, you can use their algorithm to dissect your own game, look at trends from openings, different phases of the game, and of course, they give you actionable puzzles based on whatever your strengths and weaknesses are. So go to aimchess.com and check it out. They automatically scrape your games from the major chess playing sites to give you the insights you need to work on your game. So if you go to aimchess.com and decide to subscribe, be sure to use the code perpetual30. Links in the show notes. So let's get back to the show.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
And we are back. And guys, one thing I have to say about the book is, you know, you alluded to cheating early in the book. And of course, I was there for some of the stories, which we hopefully will touch upon. But you also talk about sort of a Soviet consortium, which there were rampant tales. I've told the story myself before that part of the reason I studied Russian in college is because Russians would always be talking to each other during my games.
I tried that too, successfully. Yeah.
Yeah. Just needed to know what they were saying. But I was glad to see, you know, not to, not for the purposes of embarrassment, but just, you know, for the sake of clarity, because you see so many reports, but you guys actually do name a few names and show a few games of games that may not have been on the up and up, big money games that may have been prearranged. I'll kick it over to you guys. I mean, I don't know if favorite is the right word, but to you, what is the biggest cheating scandal or the one that listeners should be aware of from all of the attempts to dishonestly earn these big prizes over the years?
Harold, you want to take that one first?
Well, yeah, I think definitely the Russian the Soviet consortium it certainly affected you in tournaments like that, and that was when with the fall of the Soviet Union, we had a lot of these players being able to travel now, and they came to the World Open in hope of seeking riches. And it needs to be said that there was two class of former Soviet Union players that were playing in this event, and those were those who were just coming and hoping to gain money, and then there was the players that they were hoping to make America their new home, players like Shabalov and Yermolinsky and so forth, who had a bigger eye. On, you know, let's not do these things because, you know, they have to make their home here now. So in 1990, there was a particular, well, let's rewind for a second. What they would do is they would play together as a team, and they came to the understanding that in critical rounds, the last round, if they were to play against each other, that they realized that a win would make more money than a draw would if they were paired against each other. So they were willing to sacrifice a game if necessary to get the larger prize, and then they would divvy out the prizes however they would. And so in 1990, there's a story in particular, and Shaba and Yermo provided great detail to us on what was going on and what was thought to be going on. And Shaba tells us the story that that going into the last round, there was this pairing of Rashkovsky. Cheshkovsky.
Cheshkovsky, yeah.
And Gleck. And they were to be playing against each other. And then Shaba had a pairing against Ilya Smirin. Yeah. And he tells a rather funny story how the sauna at the Adams Mark Hotel served to be a sort of headquarters for the consortium. Rashkovsky would say, well, what's gonna happen in your game? Are you guys going to play? And then they said, no, we're gonna take a draw here. So, and they didn't want any part of what was going on there. And Rashkovsky says, well, I can tell you one thing. There is going to be a result in this game of Cheshkovsky and Gleck. So,
meaning someone's going to win. It's not going to be a draw. Yeah,
that's correct. And that was all the more reason why the Shaba and Smirin didn't want to be any part of that. You know, basically, they were telling him, you know, a draw isn't going to be good enough for your game. He was giving them information right there, but they didn't use that to their advantage. They said, "Let's make this draw."
Well, they weren't part of the consortium anyway.
They were not. Yeah, and then Gleck ended up winning the game, this was a problem for the American players who were. That they could have this sort of advantage. And it wasn't until, 1994? Yeah. Where Rashkovsky thought he was going to get one pairing in the final round, and he ended up getting King Luc Van Wely.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, and he ended up... So Deutschberg actually... changed the pairings or adopted a different method of doing the pairings, let's just say, to make sure that two former Soviet Union players
former Soviet Union, right. It was Soviet Union, but they were still in Russia. Yeah.
Yeah, and they were not paired against each other in the last round. And so I think this effectively ended any of their future further attempts.
Yeah. So just to clarify for listeners, obviously, you can generally make a guess at what the pairing will be if it's done by the book, if it's done according to the letter.
Computer will come up with that he might change.
Yeah. But Deutschberg basically unilaterally made a rule that I can change the pairings because he felt like he had to do something about these groups cheating. And I'm sure that there were, it's great that you guys, and the game, you have in the book, the Gleck game you referenced, it is not the most sparkling game you'll see.
pretty poor, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm sure there were others as well. And you from the class sections, you guys have a couple stories as well, but I'm sure there have been others.
But they cheat very poorly in the class section. They play worse and they cheat worse, they're not used to playing for money. So
I was directly involved in one just a few years ago where I was suspecting a guy. He was standing up wearing sunglasses like he was giving a simul. and he smoked his opponent in like 20 something moves. He was playing the black side of a French defense. This was in the under 2200 section. This is like, you ever see the show Stupid Criminals or Dumb Criminals, whatever they call it? So this guy, he plays his game and he's doing well. He's won a few games. And then he goes up to our friend Natasha Christensen and he goes, do you have a mixed doubles partner? you know, which is something that's prevalent at Continental Chess Association events, where you can have a female player and a male player, and they can be a team. And he says, you would do good by teaming up with me because I'm going to win my section. So, and then, of course, Natasha came right to me and said, this guy, do you know this guy, what's going on? I said, yeah, we're kind of keeping an eye on this guy. And that just kind of confirmed it a little bit more. And then here's the kicker. Here's what tops the cake is we get a call from this guy's ex-girlfriend saying that the guy was here with a friend and they were working together to cheat. And so it just goes to show to you that if you plan on doing something nefarious, don't let your girlfriend in on it
or at least don't break up with her.
Yeah, she could become the ex-girlfriend, right?
Right.
And then hang you out to dry. So what Goitschberg did for the following round is he isolated this player in a room with somebody else, and one director was in there, Jabari Magreen, and his level of play was far less, and he lost the game, and that was that. So,
and was that the guy that tried to cheat at a Sudoku tournament too, or was
no, that was what's his name,
Rouses, right?
No. That was the Cat in the Hat for Varshavsky.
Cat in the Hat, right?
Yeah. That was the 2009 Philadelphia Inquirer, I think, Sudoku event.
Hard to keep all the cheaters straight. Well, but we do need to tell one more cheater story, at least briefly, which is the legendary air quotes John von Neumann appearance at the World Open.
Yeah, that you were there for that one, Ben.
I was. I remember me and a young Greg Shahadi just gawking at the whole spectacle.
Yeah, you know, sometimes criminals seem to want to get caught. That
yeah.
was an example of that.
And Joel, you were there as well, right?
Yeah, no, I witnessed all that stuff. I wrote about it. I wrote about it in great detail in Chess Chow, you know, which was a contemporary magazine that I edited at the time. And so... thankfully, because I was able to recount a lot of details of it because I had written it down then. And so this is, you know, it's a phony chess player, and they get, you know, a black guy with dreadlocks who's called von Neumann, which, of course, is a famous name from computer science, but also, you know, doesn't really fit the picture. So he's very suspicious before he even makes a move. And it's a guy who doesn't know how to play chess. It was very clear that he understood the algebraic notation so that he could execute a chess move, but he couldn't play. And it was just gave him away. So obviously, you know, it was like the easiest cheating detection ever. The only thing they didn't know how he cheated. They didn't know exactly, you know, how the system worked, but it was just obvious from everything else that he couldn't play the games.
Yeah, it was strange. I understand he was just looking around the room, not really appearing to be focused on his game. The notation he was using was like, instead of knight f3, he would go g1 to f3. Like something you would see like in an old
Sergei Kudrin long form.
yeah and certainly in round two he drew Grandmaster Helgi Olafsson, so that was a very surprising result there. But he would lose his games in the most mysterious of ways and puzzling of ways, like his game against Danny Shapiro. After the Shapiro's move 9, queen takes d6, he just sat there and let his clock run out. So we can only speculate that whatever transmission lines of communication between him and his confederate had gone blank. There was radio silence there.
Yeah.
And he just sat there and let his clock run out. Unbelievable situation there.
That's how you often catch these guys is how they play when you know they're not cheating, And he literally could not play without someone telling him moves. And the Cat in the Hat, Orshovsky in 2006, he was absolutely terrible when he played on his own. And, that made it very clear.
Yeah. Fun stories and more details in the book. But there's also just, again, tales of other types of hijinks, which I don't know who was responsible for writing this section, but British Grandmaster David Norwood, who, of course, has gone on to great success in the financial world. He doesn't seem to be so active in chess these days, but he made an appearance. And there was one game that I vaguely remember from my teenage years where he was just lining up drink after drink as he played. And there were like 17 glasses. Harold, I don't know if it was you or Joel who wrote that, but could you tell a bit about that story?
It was definitely Joel.
And I remember it. The only thing that is slightly shrouded in mystery is just how many. I remember something like 26. I think.
Wow.
I think Norwood thought it was 20, and I have to say he was really great about this because I tracked him down. I was hoping to get the game score. Which he didn't have, but he did basically give the contours of the game, which was good enough. And he very enthusiastically wrote about the story, which, you know, he chalks up to, you know, youthful indiscretion. Right. You know, he knows it was wrong what he did, you know, but he wasn't ashamed of it. He told in great detail, you know, all the I actually wish I could even put more of it, but I had to edit it slightly for space because it was a long story. But
so, what did you leave out?
Well, just you know, some personal details about what was going on in the tournament and why he was in such a state. He'd actually just lost to Yermo in the eighth round. You know, he was a contender for first. He lost to Yermo. Yermo ended up winning the tournament, so he was a little distraught. And what I didn't know at the time is that although he became very successful, that he was worried about his finances at that time. Like there was a deal that was going south for him, so he was actually very conscious of the fact that he had lost money in the tournament by dropping that game. So he was a little bit out of sorts for that last game. And what he did was he basically went back and forth between the board and the bar. And when he got to the board, he had friends giving him drinks.
Right, game. Friends in their quotes.
And,
yeah,
and that's how he actually spoke very warmly of Carol Jarecki for keeping the situation in hand and, not making a big deal about it.
Right. Well, you guys mentioned in the book that she was the one who was like lining up the glasses like trophies. And of course, he's in the sort of cordoned off area. And this is what I remember, like me and Greg Chahadi just going and looking, pointing and laughing at the, 20 drinks lined up while he plays on the one of the highest boards in the room. Very, very funny. Very funny story. And Joel, hearing both you discuss you're needing the money in your most recent co-title for the World Open and the financial ramifications of Norwood's game, that was one recurring plot line that I enjoyed. Like you talked about how Nick DeFermian perform well in money games, whereas others might sort of wilt under the pressure. What patterns do you notice when you look at how these players react to playing a chess game for, say, $15,000-$20,000?
Well, the thing is, we interviewed the heroes of the World Open, who were guys that generally won the tournament multiple times. And there's a reason why they won multiple times is because they had ice water in their veins, that they were able to handle the pressure. And, that's just it. They just, thought that this is my job and I'm just going to focus on the pieces and do the best I can. I actually talked about this in a completely different book, Better Thinking, Better Chess. You know, talked about, you know, how things can go wrong, you know, like flaws in cognitive approach. And I mentioned, you know, the one game I had, and this was actually, you know, fairly recent, where I got a position I liked out of the opening. And suddenly I started thinking about, hey, you know, I'm going to win this game. I might get back into the U.S. Championship. And then, like, I blundered almost immediately,
right?
You know, because I'm thinking about the wrong things. I'm distracted. You can't let that happen. And I mentioned that, you know, I wish I had more Shaba in me, because Shaba, like every week, it's, you know, it would be like a new last round game. And yeah, he lost plenty of them. But it never stayed with him for the next time. He would go out, he'd play the same, and he'd win, and he won a lot of them, you know. And in the end, it's better to lose some and win some than to draw a lot of them, which is what, right, I usually did, you know, because no fear of losing. That's really the important thing, is that you cannot fear losing.
Huh. And do you think that's something that can be worked on, or is it pretty innate?
I think it's, you know, part of it is individual's personality, but yeah, part of it can be worked on. You know, like I have a student right now that I'm working with who is up and coming, and you know, she shows me these games with grandmasters, and I say, you were too afraid of this guy. You don't realize he's afraid of you. You're up and coming. You can knock him off, but you have to believe you can knock him off. You can't play scared. You have to play this like you're playing a lower rated player and you want to win the game. Play with fear.
And one of our heroes, Ilya Nizhnik, he talks about psychological burdens. And that he didn't want to put himself under any psychological pressure, like feeling that he had to win a particular game, or that he had to win with white, you know, win with white, draw with black, like they used to say. He didn't want to put himself under that additional pressure. He just wanted to play the game and see what the result of the game was. I think it's good not to put yourself under that kind of pressure in a game and just make the moves and concentrate on that.
Yeah, I found the Nizhnik chapter very instructive generally about how he navigates these fields. And he's still a young man. So he keeps playing these World Opens, he could win a lot of them.
He struck us as a kind of confident yet humble kind of guy. He was an impressive young man to talk to.
Yeah, not wholly surprising then, the success he had. So one more story that I thought might be fun for you guys to share with our listeners is, you know, Edward Gufeld, his name has come up on the podcast here and there, and people have not made people have, you know, generally we try not to criticize those who have passed, but his reputation is unique in the chess world. So what stories could we share about Gufeld's behavior at the World Open?
Oh, I could certainly. We could talk about other stories at other tournaments, but
yeah, we could.
I don't think we want to go there. So, but in particular, there's this game against Sunil Wiramantri that he played that we feature in the book. And prior to this, Gufeld had a game against. It was a former Soviet player way back when that he would go around and show, this is my Mona Lisa.
Bagheerov.
Bagheerov, yeah.
And I saw a lecture that he gave in Seattle years ago where he showed the Mona Lisa.
And by the way, Bagheerov was one of Shabalov's mentors as well. He had a choice. He can go. He had the ideal setup. After school as a young boy, growing up in Latvia, he had a choice. He could work with Tal as a because he was a top Latvian junior, or he could work with Bagheerov because it was paid for by the federation. So on any particular day, he can go and work with either of them. And
this is Shabalov, to be clear.
Yeah, yeah. And you think he would be more influenced by Tal, but Bagirov was no less of an influence to him. And he picked up a lot of things, like some of his openings. Semislav Alyekin's defense, English opening, he picked up from Bagirov, and also his endgame play. He learned a lot from Bagirov as well. But getting back to the Weerimantri and Gufeld story, so it was round five in the 1996 World Open, and Sunil comes to the board, and Gufeld's sitting there already, and he says in a very lighthearted way, "Oh, I see that we're playing against each other." And Gufeld responded, "You don't play me, I play you." Okay. And Sunil was kind of taken aback a little bit.
Genuinely angry, right? Like,
yes, just what kind of greeting is that, you know? Sunil plays the game, and a beautiful miniature of 20 moves. He just absolutely smoked him.
Yeah,
and that Gufeld has he didn't shake hands. You know, this was unfortunately typical of the guy, and he said to Sunil, "Don't let me catch you outside of the United States," so in a kind of like threatening way.
Yeah,
and it was a few years later, believe it or not, that he did apologize to Sunil. At a U.S. Open, and he also had nice things to say of a young Hikaru, you know.
But, yeah, we should say Sunil, of course, Hikaru's stepdad, and yeah. Hikaru was just an up-and-comer at that time.
But this is one of many, many stories that of Gufeld. And so, I named this game Sunil's Mona Lisa.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about Gufeld a bit, not to pile on too much because there are a million of these stories, but let's just say he was a very unpleasant opponent, and I did have one game. I beat him a couple of times in Hawaii, but I did have one game in the U.S. Open that I won with some beautiful sacrifices, and I called it my Mona Lisa, and there was a hospitality room there run by Eric Schiller, and for grandmasters and juniors. So every few hours I'd say, "Juniors, gather around, another showing of the Mona Lisa." But aside from that, I lost a few games to him, and he was an unpleasant opponent. And I did, you know, I usually didn't respond well to that kind of hostility. It was a distraction for me. But different players take it differently. For instance, Fedorovich thrives on conflict, you know. it's like the Bruce Lee movies, you draw blood from him and you're dead, that's it, right? Kind of like that with Fed. If Fed was angry, you are gone. He was great. It was great motivation for him, so that worked. Hostility, that, you know, anger, that worked for Fed. But not for most players. But in the book, we learn from Alexander Golden, he had a very interesting approach to the problem of Gufeld, because he didn't really respond well to hostility. He didn't want to be angry, but instead he thought of Gufeld as a comical character, goofy. He was playing goofy, and he thought, like, this guy is just a joke, you know, and that put him, you know, in a lighthearted, a happy mood, and he was able to win the game. And Harold, I think, can amplify on this this connection that you came up with to the Miracle on Ice story.
Alex Golden, first of all, he's kind of more of a spiritual guy. He's a Reiki master, by the way, so he has this kind of relaxed look, you know, at the world. So, you know, he just thought of him merely as funny. And it reminded me of the Miracle on Ice. I saw that movie with Kurt Russell, And
who asked me to take a picture with him at the National Junior High School Championship in 1994 because one of his kids played.
Now, if we remember back to the 1980 Olympic team, they had played an exhibition match against the Soviets a few weeks prior to the actual Olympics, and they got blown out of the water. You know, it was some ridiculous score. And so, you know, they knew that they would probably be facing the Soviets down the line at some point in the Olympics. So Herb Brooks made light of the fact that one of their captain, Tretyov or something like that, I forget without looking at the book, bore an uncanny resemblance to Stan Laurel of the famous Laurel and Hardy comedy duo. And he made a joke of it, saying, "How can you lose to Stan Laurel? How can you look at lose to a team like this?" And he kind of made light of the fact that, you know, that this guy was, you know, a behemoth as a hockey player, and they thought of him in the fact as this funny character. And just these kind of mind games worked positively in the situation. So that's what I was reminded of when Golden was telling the story of he just thought of this unpleasant opponent as being merely funny.
Hmm. Well, good advice for anyone, because obviously Gufeld was one of a kind, but we all sometimes play people who are clearly, whether intentionally or not, potentially getting under our skin. So it's good to adopt the Zen approach of Alexander Golden. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we will dive into the listener questions for our co-authors, Grandmaster Joel Benjamin and Harold Scott. Our friends at Chessable keep dropping new courses. Some of their latest include Play the Open Sicilian One by Grandmaster Miguel Santos. That's got 15 trainable lines that you can use to play against the Open Sicilian, kind of one-stop shopping for an opening that can be overwhelming to learn. And friend of the pod, Simon Williams, is out with The Harry Attack, fighting kingside fianchettos after 1d4, along with I Am Richard Palliser. And they've got tons of new stuff coming from Grandmaster Hans Niemann, Lineard Dominguez, and the list goes on. And all of their courses, of course, utilize spaced repetition to help you remember the opening or tactical sequence or end game that you learn. So be sure to go to chessable.com and take a look at what is new.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back, and here is our first listener question. So number one, Joel, following up on our first interview, which was episode 104, December 2018, some great stories in that one that listeners should definitely check out if they haven't already. And you alluded earlier, Joel, to Chess Chow magazine, of course, legendary sort of satirical news coverage of the chess world. And Jonathan Evans writes in to ask, he says, I had a subscription to Chess Chow, but had to sell it when money was tight. Do you have any plans to sell your stockpile, or do you know if there's a place to get them? I check eBay often, but haven't seen any yet.
I probably have most of the outstanding copies of Chess Chow. So he should let me know what issues he needs, and maybe I'll be able to put that together to sell. I don't have every single issue that I could sell, but I have most of them.
Okay, so maybe I can put you guys in touch privately, Joel. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yeah, and definitely for listeners who do try to track it down, I only have a couple issues myself, even though I did read many of them when they came out, as we talked about in the prior interview. And related to chess improvement, and of course, again, you mentioned Better Thinking, Better Chess, which I have recommended before, as we discussed before. It's a great book, along with Liquidation on the Chessboard and your other works, Joel. Alex Friedman writes in to ask, he says, Wikipedia says that Joel Benjamin is known for converting very small advantages into a win. Any tips on how to get good at that? Personally, I'm mostly known for converting very big advantages into a loss.
maybe he should be known for his sense of humor. That's pretty funny. The most interesting part of that question actually is who wrote that Wikipedia? Because you know, that's something we don't think about. You know, we mostly, you know, take Wikipedia for granted that it's mostly true, but you know, a lot of these things are the opinions of the people who write, and I do not know who maybe a lot of people have been involved in writing my Wikipedia page. I know that my mom has gone on to correct a few errors from time to time. But anyway, I would say that converting small advantages, I don't know if I'm, you know, really known for it, but it's part of my arsenal. But you know, what's the key to it is patience. You know, a lot of people, they want to win quickly. They want to win with fun. Converting small advantages is not often that much fun, and it often takes a while. So you have to be patient. You have to understand that very often you win the game, not even necessarily because of your winning plan, but because your opponent gets tired of being tortured and you know, makes a run for it and fails, and you win in some other unexpected way. But a big key to exploiting small advantages is understanding small advantages. So, you know, you have to learn some strategy. So you have to, you know, study some books on various strategy. And there is literature that covers this kind of thing. I didn't write so much about small advantages, but I did have a chapter in Better Thinking, Better Chess called Winning the One Game. I also had a chapter called Swindling, winning the lost game and winning the one game, because I think, you know, those are, you know, very important parts of chess. But you know, it's not there's no magic wand for it. It's difficult. But I think that all grandmasters are able to do those things these days. You know, the players are very versatile.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the need for being patient. And I think in our book, we talk about Ilya Smirin when he was facing lower rated opponents. He knew that, you know, they could play many, many good moves, but there would come to a point that they would make their mistake and he would outclass them. And he realized the need to be patient when facing a lower rated opponents and not necessarily to jump on the first little misstep that they often tend to do. So, yeah, I think that's a great lesson that you say, being patient in those positions.
Yeah, I've experienced that even recently. And to Alex's question, obviously, if you have the patience for it, you can practice against engines and converting advantages. I personally always get flagged as a weakness of mine by the aim chess algorithm, converting advantages, but I don't have the patience to sit there and practice against a computer like I should. But certainly it would be a good thing to do.
Don't practice on this computer, because the computers always defend. You know?
Yeah.
That's depressing.
Yeah, but I mean, even if I practice like up two pawns, like it would probably be really good for my game. Although, like you say, Joel, I'd probably lose some of them. That would be super, super depressing. So what other, before we wrap up, guys, what other advice could we extrapolate from, you know, this deep dive into all these legendary players for how to approach Swisses and sort of the psychological side of managing a long, tiring chess tournament?
Well, first of all, you have to be in a good place. You know, you have to be hungry. You know, like you don't want to play in too many tournaments or too few tournaments beforehand. So you don't want to be rusty. You don't want to be stale either. You have to feel good about how things are going. You have to feel confident. you have to be prepared. It doesn't mean you have to have encyclopedic knowledge of openings, but you know, you don't want to go into the game and waste a lot of time thinking about what your strategy is going to be. You know, for the stronger players, the more sophisticated players, there's extra things. We learned a lot from our heroes. Like Shaba said that he would prepare one specific novelty, one new thing, one new twist, and he would save it. He would save it for an important moment. He wouldn't waste it in an early round. But if he got into a money game where he might be able to use it, then he'd spring it. So, you know, sometimes, you know, for the lower sections, sometimes if you have a little bit of a surprise, you know, like players might get used to you playing a certain opening, they might, you know, see some of your games and be ready for it. If you have something new, that can maybe throw them off balance.
Yeah, I also think it's very important to get yourself in a proper routine for the tournament, making sure you're getting a proper sleep. And also, if you have a late game, sometimes food is not often available at late hours. So make sure you don't have to be spending extra time hunting around for food in the middle of the night in Philadelphia somewhere.
You want to stay out of the Denny's, you know, because that would take forever.
Yeah. I had screenshotted the story of John Ems when he was chasing his grandmaster title. You guys had a contribution from him.
Yeah.
And I had screenshotted it and asked him on Twitter if he remembered it. And then Natasha Regan chimed in, and like there was apparently a British contingent there that year that traveled together and had, you know, coaches underwritten by the British Federation, as it turned out. But yeah, they were reminiscing about that Denny's at 3 a.m. the long wait to try to get food.
Yeah, you don't want to find yourself on that line.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely want to plan ahead when it comes to eat, sleep, and all that stuff.
Yeah, like Ilya Nizhnik said, eat, sleep, chess, repeat. You know,
That's good.
Yeah. I might not have put it in the proper order there, but you know, he sounds like he had himself a proper routine. Ready to play long games if necessary.
You know, I think players. I don't really know because my finger is not on the pulse so much, but I think that players today maybe are a little bit more responsible than they were in my day because there was a fair amount of drinking going on during the World Open. And I have to say that almost every World Open playoff, because at some point, you know, Goitschberg decided I want a clear winner. So if people tie, going to be a playoff and the winner will get a little extra money. A lot of the players were not sober for those playoffs. And I actually won a playoff after I had been in the player sports bar for several hours waiting for Alexander Ivanov and Julian Hodgson to finish their game, which impacted first place. So, you know, I suggested that perhaps, Sam Adams was not the best training partner for the playoff, but managed to be okay in the end.
He was your second.
Yeah. First, second, my 20th.
Third.
No, I'm no Norwood, but
right.
20, I would not have won the playoff.
Well, great stuff, guys. We do have one more listener question, and this is from our mutual friend and the founder of the Chess Book Collectors Group, Brian Karen, who, and of course, as we record this, you guys will be doing a book signing in a few days at the U.S. Amateur Team East legendary team tournament here on the Eastern Seaboard. And listeners, stay tuned because I'm going to get a couple signed books to give away to do as a contest. So when we say our goodbyes, listen for instructions on that. But Brian asks if there's any chance you guys would do a similar treatment to the U.S. Amateur Team East, a similar book.
Sure. Well, Brian's a great guy and well known in the chess community, and his pages on Facebook are great. I love Chess Book Collectors. But you know, I actually did kick around the idea of, you know, because we just celebrated the 50th anniversary 2 years ago of the amateur team East, and there's a lot of great history there. But unlike this project that I worked on with Joel, we had some great resources. Not only did we have Chess Life, we had New in Chess, Inside Chess, we had Chess Chow, and we had Informant database and to find games, and also the Megabase. And I think it would just be a much harder project to get games from the database, because not many of the games are. We'd basically have to rely on a Chess Life for the source material.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the if you go to the amateur team, Steve Doyle puts up these cardboard things collages. with all the collages with all the pictures from past years.
Yeah.
So I actually think like a picture book would be maybe even more interesting.
That's a good idea to
summarize that, but it would be very hard to do a good job, I think, on the amateur team from a game standpoint.
Yeah, I think that that in contrast to the World Open, it's not the same in terms of the hardcore chess of the memorable games. It's more about stories, but there is something there about culture. I mean, it's not quite the same audience. It's not your typical chess audience, but this book has kind of made me think about the importance of recounting culture in books, especially American chess culture for our audience. So that is an angle that has got my attention, and it might be projects down the road in that realm.
Well, that's great to hear, because again, I can't recommend this book enough.
Whether you can recommend it more, it's okay.
whether you're someone like me who sort of intersected with a lot of these stories very tangentially, but even if you're from outside the U.S., I mean, the you get so many great little bios, you get actionable tournament advice, and of course, there's the high level chess games in here as well. I mean, it was amazing, just to see all the names that sort of passed through in the course of all the annotated games, because of course the people that have won it the most I probably could have named, but then there's so many grandmasters who, as I alluded to, like a young Hikaru, and my coach Axel Bachmann makes a cameo, like just Magesh, just so many grandmasters coming when they're young. And then they end up, some of them end up being top players, some of them end up being trainers, some of them end up like Norwood, operating a hedge fund or whatever it is exactly that he does. But it's just a nice little slice of chess history. So thanks guys for taking the time to write this and to come on the pod.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you again for having us.
My pleasure. And again, listeners, so I'll record the instructions for the contest separately so I don't screw it up. But we'll be giving away a couple copies. I'm going to see these gentlemen personally this weekend, get them to sign a few books, and then give them away. So stay tuned for instructions if you'd like to participate in that. So thanks again, guys. And we will. I'll see you in a few days.
Sounds good.
All right, listeners, we're going to do a giveaway of this fantastic book, Winning the World Open. I am going to give away 2 signed copies signed by the authors. I will also sign it myself if the winner of the contest wants. That will be up to you. So the instructions are going to be similar to past contests. We just want you to leave a review on a podcast platform, a 5-star review. You can say whatever you want. You can be critical, but give us 5 stars, hook us up. If you don't like it, you shouldn't be listening. So hopefully you give the pod 5 stars. So it can be preferably on Apple Podcasts, but if you've already done Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, if you can't find a platform to leave a review and you still want to enter the contest, I won't disqualify you. So all you have to do is send a screenshot with a review, if you're able to ben@perpetualchesspod.com. In the subject line, please use the subject line contest. and then you will be entered. And I will announce the winners 2 weeks after this podcast comes out. I will let the winner know via email. But again, just send an email with a screenshot of a 5-star/positive review on any podcast platform, preferably Apple Podcasts, but any will do. Send to Ben at perpetualchesspod.com with the subject contest, and you are in. I may not respond to every entrant right away, but if your email doesn't bounce, you'll be in the contest. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you all next week. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, BennyFishel1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, and or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.